There is a fifth dimension, beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition. It lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Dimensions, a Twilight Zone podcast. On tonight's episode, we will be discussing Season 2, Episode 23, titled 100 Yards Over the Rim. This episode was written by Rod Serling, directed by Buzz Kulik, produced by Buck Houghton, music by Marius Constant, and in the cast were Cliff Robertson, John Crawford, Evans Evans, Edward Platt, and John Astin. It was originally aired on April 7th of 1961. And, of course, you can watch it on FreeVTV, TubiTV, Paramount Plus, or the DVDs and Blu-rays. And, as always, if you haven't seen this episode since Reagan introduced trickle-down economics, go back and watch it before you listen to this episode, because there are spoilers if you haven't seen this episode before. So, with that being said, let's move into the opening narration. The year is 1847. The place is the territory of New Mexico. The people are a tiny handful of men and women with a dream. 11 months ago, they started out from Ohio and headed west. Someone told them about a place called California, about a warm sun and a blue sky, about rich land and fresh air, and at this moment, almost a year later, they've seen nothing but cold, heat, exhaustion, hunger, and sickness. This man's name is Christian Horn. He has a dying 8-year-old son and a heartsick wife. And he's about the only one remaining who has even a fragment of the dream left. Mr. Chris Horn, who's going over the top of a rim to look for water and sustenance, and in a moment will move into the Twilight Zone. So, again, we see Serling in the action when he gives his opening monologue, opening narration, which we love to see it. We love to see it, right? Rod Serling steps out, he's standing by a covered wagon, he tells you all about it, and it's a great thing. Savor the flavor, because it doesn't last forever, unfortunately. But we'll get to that when we get to that. So we meet Cliff Robertson, a.k.a. Christopher Horn, who is part of a wagon train, what you could call, I guess, the original Oregon Trail. Apparently, a couple of wagons had died of dysentery, and here we are now with only 3 wagons left, and they're heading to California. Now, the other 2 wagons in the party are very downtrodden, very disillusioned, very disheartened at everything. They have very little food, very little water. There's not a lot of game left. Now, in 1847, there would have been more game. Maybe not necessarily in New Mexico. But you got to remember, this is around the time when America was doing a lot with the Native Americans. And one of the government's ideas to sort of hurt the Native Americans was to demolish the buffalo, one of the things that they thrived on. And it wasn't until about 1870 to 1880 that we completely wiped out the buffalo population, somewhere in that neighborhood. So this is a little before that. But we decimated the buffalo population, mostly, one, because it was lucrative, there was money involved, and two, it was another way to kind of stick it to the Native Americans to kind of hurt them a little since we, you know, kind of moved them more toward out that way, and then we, just for, you know, funsies, decided to kill all the buffalo. Well, this not only hurt the Native Americans, this also hurt a lot of the settlers that were trying to settle in the West, because, you know, you take away food for the Native Americans, you know, you also take food away from the people that are trying to make it to the West to establish a greater nation, so to speak. And so, you know, this might have been the start of that, but it's a little earlier than what history records as the time that all that took place. But regardless, we've got three wagons full of people. They can't find food. They're having a hard time finding water even. And two of the three wagons want to turn back and head back to St. Louis to refuel, restop, regather themselves, and possibly go somewhere else. Who knows? But they want off the ride. So, of course, this makes Christian Horn kind of upset. You know, we've gone so far. If you turn back now, you're going to travel another 1,500 miles, and you'll be dead in the sand before you even get close to St. Louis. And on top of all that, on top of dealing with the other two wagons full of people and their dissatisfaction with the journey, they would rate it very low on Yelp, if Yelp was a thing at the time. They want to turn back and head to St. Louis. So on top of that, and Christopher Horn knows that if two of the three wagons leave, they're as good as sunk too. So it's for personal interest also that he wants to keep the other two wagons with him. And on top of all that, his wife is beside himself because their son has had a fever for the last week and he is dying. So Chris, in a last-ditch effort to figure something out, to find something to eat, something to drink, do something to help, he decides to go over a sand dune that's, you know, a little ways away to see if he can see anything that would resemble any sort of food, water, shelter, anything that could help them along their journey. So he travels over the rim and he sees a road. So going over the rim, he transported himself into modern times, i.e., 1961, where there is now blacktop paved roads, telephone and electrical wiring, and road signs. So he goes down to the road, he starts walking the road, he sees a sign that says Joe's Cafe a mile ahead. He starts walking and almost gets run over by a large truck. In the process of dodging the truck, he, of course, jumps out of the way. When he does, the rifle or musket or it actually looks like a Springfield Model 1870 rifle. He jumps out of the way. It goes off, and it hurts his wrist in the process. But he picks up his gun. He heads on his way and walks the mile down the road to Joe's Air Flight Cafe, and we see Joe standing outside, and he invites Chris in. They give him some water. Chris starts talking, you know, of course he's, you know, beside himself about where he is and what's going on, and of course Joe and his wife are flabbergasted about how a man could claim to be from, you know, 100 years in the past. But Mary Lou, Joe's wife, helps bandage Chris's hand because she was a nurse's aide for a while before they had the cafe. And they decide, Joe and Mary Lou, to call a doctor to come look at Chris. And the doctor comes and looks at him. He examines him. They have him laying down in another room. The The doctor says that there's nothing physically wrong with him other than he's out of his gourd because he thinks it's, you know, 1847 and not 1961. Mary Lou gave Chris some antibiotics for his wrist when she bandaged him. She gave him the bottle. But the doctor wants to call some people that deal with other parts of health, i.e. the above-the-neck kind, and wants to have Chris examined because even the doctor said that, you know, it doesn't make sense because if you look at him, he has all the physical characteristics and ailments and even dental work of a man that would have been alive in the mid-1800s. So it doesn't make sense, but he still wants to have him checked out anyway. About this time, Chris comes out of the back and says, "You're not going to do that to me." So they decide to, you know, try to hold him, but he doesn't want to, you know, he's not staying. He grabs his gun. He pops Joe in the gut with it one time and goes running down the road back to where he came over the ridge, about a mile. The sheriff shows up. He and Joe decide to go chase after Chris. They catch up to him. Chris starts running over the ridge to where he knew the wagons were. He drops his gun. He runs over the ridge, and he disappears from Joe and the sheriff. But he reappears in 1847 at the wagon train. Now, he's been gone for a little while, but according to the people in the wagon train, he literally just left and he came right back. They thought something was wrong, like he forgot something. But he gives his wife the antibiotics that Mary Lou gave him, told him to give them to the kid. He'll be all right. And we then see the sheriff and the Joe, the owner of the cafe. They come back, and Joe now has Chris's rifle, but Chris's rifle looks like it was buried in the sand for 100 years, as opposed to being just dropped 10 minutes prior. And of course, it's a mystery. Now, to me, the best part of the episode, or one of the coolest things, one of the things that made it Twilight Zone-y, was that while Chris was in the back room after the doctor was looking at him, he found a medical book or an encyclopedia, and he found his son's name in the book as being a driving force behind antibiotics and the curing of childhood diseases and that sort of thing. So, but back to the future, back to the past. Joe and Mary Lou and the sheriff all see the gun. The gun is obviously been out in the sand for 100 years, and no one can explain it, of course, because it's the Twilight Zone. And we get, at that point, the closing narration. "Mr. Christian Horn, one of the hardy breed of men who headed west during a time when there were no concrete highways or the solace of civilization. Mr. Christian Horn and family and party heading west after a brief detour to the Twilight Zone." So this will start, this episode will start the last few episodes of season 2, which are a fantastic group of episodes, starting with this one, next week going to the Rip Van Winkle Caper, and then The Silence, and then a little further on down the line we get Will the Real Martians Please Stand Up, and we will get The Obsolete Man. Now, we're not worried about those just yet. We'll get there in a couple weeks. But for right now, were worried about 100 yards over the rim. Now, this is one of those episodes that I've always loved. I always loved this one, even as a kid. Even as a kid, I loved this episode. It was well written, I think well acted. Certainly a lot of work was put into this episode to make it better than some of the other ones we've previously had. Again, even Serling himself said, you know, a third were great, a third were really, you know, were decent, and then a third were turkeys. You know, we've seen a few turkeys, we've seen some greats, and we've seen some goods, and this is, to me, I don't know if I'd necessarily call it great, but it's so close to great, you might as well call it great, at least in my opinion. I like this episode a lot, and Cliff Robertson really sells the idea of a man that's kind of out of his element, but not in an over-the-top way that they can kind of do in movies and television shows of the like, where people are just so flabbergasted to be in a different time that, you know, they're, everything is crazy and all this other stuff, and he plays it a little more subdued, which I appreciate. I really think it's well done. And I think that the owners of the diner, Joe and Mary Lou, I think they play their parts well, because they equally play it as subdued as Cliff Robertson does, John Crawford and Evans. Although the weakest point, I think, would be Mary Lou, played by Evans. She's almost annoying in a sort of way. Not that it's a bad thing. There's definitely way worse, more annoying characters in the Twilight Zone than Mary Lou. But, you know, we still have to deal with it. And then, of course, we get the addition of the Doctor, played by Edward Platt, who was always very good at what he did. He was always, you know, he was a man that could play serious or funny, and he got famous playing funny, but we'll get to that when we get to his biography. But it was just a fantastic episode, and I don't, you know, whatever your feedback, but, you know, if you like it, let me know. If you don't like it, let me know. Email me, dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com. This one always seems to be an episode that gets either forgiven or it gets a lot of love. It seems like people either forget that it exists, or it's like this is one of the better time-traveling episodes of the Twilight Zone. And it could really be one or the other. And it usually gets either a great reception or a lukewarm at best reception. I've never really heard anyone that says, I hate this episode, I wish it would burn and die. That's never the case. It's either it's all right, or my goodness, that's a great episode and I love it and it's fantastic. And you never really get an in-between with it, which, honestly, I think, you know, I think there's a lot to be said about the in-between. Because, again, not everything's going to be great, and not everything's just going to be complete trash. You're going to have a nice little lukewarm middle, and there's nothing wrong with that. So, with that, let's get into the bios. So, let's start with Mr. Christian Horn himself, Cliff Robertson. Now, Cliff Robertson was born in 1923, and he passed away at the age of 88 in 2011. Now, he was born in Texas to Clifford Parker Robinson Jr., his mother, and Audrey Willingham, his mother. They were a couple that owned a ranch, and they divorced when he was a year old, and a year later his mother died of peritonitis, where Cliff was then shipped off to be raised by his aunt, uncle, and grandmother. He got interested in acting, and after a strong stage presence, he made his debut into television, also to somewhat of a strong opening, so to speak, to where he moved between television and movies, to where his first film debut was in the 1955 movie Picnic. He then went on to play Joan Crawford's deranged young husband in the 1956 movie Autumn Leaves, and was given leads in films such as The Naked and the Dead in 1958, Gidget in 1959, and The Big Show in 1961. Throughout the 50s and early 60s, he went back and forth from being on some, you know, playing some interesting characters on television, including The Days of Wine and Roses and Underworld USA, and in the hospital melodrama The Interns. However, he wasn't gaining a lot of traction in his career. Although he was working steadily, he wasn't really, you know, gaining much traction until he was picked by JFK to play JFK as a younger man in the movie PT 109 in 1963. This kind of gave him the boost he needed to get some better acting roles, to where he played a ruthless presidential candidate in the 1964 picture The Best Man. He played in the movie The Honeypot in 1967, and he also played a mentally challenged man in the 1968 movie Charlie, for which he won an Academy Award for Best Actor. This led him to be able to remain somewhat of a leading man into the 70s, starring in such films as Too Late the Hero, The Great Northfield Minnesota Raid, and Obsession in 1976. He also worked behind the camera some, where he wrote, directed, and co-produced the 1971 movie J.W. Coop and The Pilot in 1980. In the 80s, he moved back to somewhat being a more supporting character in movies and television, having supporting roles, one playing Hugh Hefner in the movie Star 80 in 1983, and more recently, or more later in his career, he had a supporting part in the movie Escape from L.A. with Kurt Russell in 1996, and playing Uncle Ben in the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man in 2002. He retired after that and lived until the age of 88, after passing away in 2011. All right, let's move on to the man that played Joe of Joe's Air Flight Cafe, Mr. John Crawford. Now, John Crawford was born in 1920 and passed away at the age of 90 in 2010. Now, he had over 200 movie and TV appearances, according to his IMDb, his career spanning 40 years, mostly playing tough and or villain kind of people in his roles. He attended the University of Washington, where he majored in drama, and that's where he was discovered by a Warner Brothers scout. And although his screen test did not go well, meaning he didn't really get into pictures, he took a job at RKO Pictures as a laborer, and then took a job at the Circle Theater in Los Angeles, also as a laborer in building sets, where he eventually persuaded them to let him be in some of their plays. This launched a stage career, which then, of course, led to Columbia Pictures signing him to supporting players in a lot of their Western pictures. He then sort of had a Clint Eastwood sort of thing where he went out of the country to make a few movies, where Clint went to Italy and such to make, you know, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and all of those spaghetti westerns, as they were called, because filmed in Italy, but they were westerns supposed to be set in Western America, so spaghetti western, where he starred in the films Orders to Kill in 1958, The Key in 1958, and Hell is a City in 1960, all of which were made in the UK. When he returned from the UK, he started a career that kept him very busy up until he retired from acting in 1986. His most memorable film roles include the chief engineer of the Poseidon in The Poseidon Adventure with Gene Hackman, Tom Iverson in the movie Night Moves in 1975, the mayor of San Francisco in the Clint Eastwood movie The Enforcer, 1976, police chief Buzz Kavanaugh in the 1977 movie Outlaw Blues, and as amiable mine hand Brian Deerling in The Boogans, 1981. While doing all this, he still maintained his presence on the small screen as well, with recurring parts as Sheriff Epp Bridges in The Waltons and Captain Parks on Policewoman, among other television shows such like I Spy, of course The Twilight Zone, Wagon Train, The Fugitive, Star Trek, Lost in Space, Stop Me If You've Heard This, Bonanza, Hogan's Heroes, Mission Impossible, Gunsmoke, The Bionic Woman, Dallas, and Dynasty. And again, he retired from acting in 1986 and passed away after complications from a stroke in September of 2010. Now let's move on to Mary Lou, although there's not a lot to say about her. Evans was born in 1936 in West Virginia and is still alive today by all reports. She was known for bit parts in 1967's Bonnie and Clyde, 1973 The Iceman Cometh, and 1989's Dead Bang, and she was also previously married to director John Frankenheimer. Not a lot is known about her, but she is still alive today, so good for her, and I hope she's doing well and is in good health. And so lastly but not leastly, let's get to the man who played the doctor, Edward Platt, who was born in 1916 and passed away at the age of 58 in 1974. So he only lived about 13 years after this episode. He was born in Staten Island, New York in 1916 and had a love of music. He attended Princeton, majoring in Romantic Languages, but only did that for a year before he left to go study at the Conservatory of Music in Cincinnati after he had aspirations of a possible operatic career. He was then later accepted into Juilliard. However, the dreams of opera shifted, and he became a band vocalist with Paul Whiteman and orchestra. He then sang bass as part of the Mozart Opera Company in New York with the Gilbert and Sullivan Opera Company in 1942. He appeared in the operettas The Mikado, The Gondoliers, and The Pirates of Penzance. During World War II, Ed served as a radio operator with the Army, and after getting out of the war, He became a radio host and did a number of musical comedy roles in radio. In 1947, he made it to Broadway with the musical Allegro, starring Jose Ferrer. And playing with Jose Ferrer again in 1952, The Strike on Broadway. In 1953, Edward moved back to Texas to be near his brother and began anchoring a local news and kids show titled Uncle Eddie's Kitty Party. Jose Ferrer remembered him and saw him on the TV and invited him to Hollywood, where Ferrer was starring in a film version of The Strike that they were in Broadway together. Ed recreated the same role he had in the play, and this started his Hollywood career. He also earned some notice as playing James Dean's understanding juvenile officer in the classic film Rebel Without a Cause in 1955. This jump-started his career, where he would go on to be in many different programs, portraying a slew of different characters from professional to shady types, everything from principals to prosecutors and mobsters to murderers. After many years of playing it serious, which included stints on General Hospital, he finally was able to focus more on comedy, where he played the chief to Don Adams' secret agent on Get Smart. Now, if you remember that show, of course you do. He played the chief on Get Smart to Maxwell Smart's secret agent. However, this was pretty much the end of his career. Mostly due to the show being such a cult following that not a lot of other, he was more or less typecast, so not a lot of other roles came his way, and he started producing shows instead of starring in them. And unfortunately, this led to some misunderstanding when he died. It was reported that he actually died from a massive heart attack. However, years later, his son said that after Get Smart had ended and the career pretty much dried up, he fell into a severe depression and, with ongoing financial pressures, committed suicide in his apartment in 1974. So that just goes to show you, fame doesn't fix everything. So it's sad to hear the chief from Get Smart unaliving himself. That's not, it's sad business. But with that, let's move on to the trivia for this episode. Now, Cliff Robertson was the kind of actor that he wasn't a method actor per se, but he did like to study up and know and you know, have the be prepared to play whatever role he was playing. And he actually prepared for playing Christian Horn in this episode by writing out a detailed treatment for his character and actually did extensive research on the 1840s time period, which the episode is set, and concluded that an Easterner, like Horn, would have worn a stovepipe hat, very similar to like Abraham Lincoln. The director thought the hat would look comical, however, and wanted him to wear more of a traditional historical, or ahistorical, Stetson hat, like would be worn like by cowboys and such. Robertson held strong with his belief of a stovepipe hat. Eventually, the feud was taken to Rod, who, after hearing both sides, decided to let Robertson wear the stovepipe hat, and that's how Christian Horn is wearing a stovepipe hat on this episode of The Twilight Zone. The Air Flight Cafe building is still standing. It's on US 395 near Grant and Olancha, California. As of 2015, the building was for sale. Director J.J. Abrams has said that this episode is his personal favorite of the entire series, which I'm not saying that J.J. Abrams is wrong, but it seems like there might have been a few other episodes he may not have seen. While this was a great episode, I don't think it's the best one, is my opinion. But then again, that's my opinion, and your opinion might differ. And that's why it's a beautiful thing. The Sheriff's Patrol car is the same 1961 Ford Galaxy that was used by the Mayberry Sheriff's Department in Season 2 of the Andy Griffith Show. So, apparently Mayberry is not that far from New Mexico. Who would have known? Christian Horn Jr., the son, was born in 1839 and died in Santa Barbara, California in 1914. This episode takes place in 1847 and 1961. When Christian is in the Air Flight Cafe, he sees a calendar denoting September of 1961. This episode aired in April of 61, 5 months before the events taking place, as denoted by the calendar on the wall. Now, Edward Platt, who played the doctor, and John Astin, who played one of the other settlers in one of the other wagons. John Astin, of course, being married to Patty Duke and having a son named Sean Astin, who was in the Goonies and Lord of the Rings and all that stuff. You know who he is. Two of the actors in the episode, Edward Platt and John Astin, would a decade later appear memorably in the sitcom The Odd Couple as separate employers of Oscar Madison, and, as is the same here, not have a scene together. Now, that'll do it for the trivia, so let's move on to the goofs. The story is set in 1847, and Christian Horn is carrying a trapdoor Springfield-style rifle made in 1866. So I was right, it was a Springfield. Christian Horn and his family are on a wagon train headed for the New Mexico Territory in 1847. The New Mexico Territory was established in 1850 on land that Mexico ceded to the United States in 1848, so they couldn't actually have been in New Mexico necessarily. The rifle, when Joe comes back from picking the rifle up after it's been in the sand for 100 years, the rifle changes hands when he walks in the door of the cafe. It was originally in his left hand, but then automatically appears in his right hand when we cut back to him. During the gas station restaurant scene, Christian has about a 4 to 5 day growth of beard. When he returns to the wagon, the growth is down to only about a day or two. When Christian is drinking the glass of water, his hand changes position on the glass when the camera cuts away and cuts back to him. At the end, when Chris brings back the penicillin for his ill son, his wife immediately flips open the plastic cap via the tab without any sort of hesitation or pause as to how to open it. Modern plastic snap cap vials weren't invented until the 20th century, and opening one would have been perplexing compared to the cork stopper or screw top glass vials of the 19th century. And then, lastly but not leastly, Alexander Fleming discovered the healing properties of a mold in a petri dish by accident in the 1920s, 2 decades after the fictional Chris Horn had died in 1914. So there's a little bit of factual inaccuracy there, but who really cares? It's the Twilight Zone. It's a great episode. It's a great show. And, you know, most of those things were nitpicky things, which would not derail your enjoyment of this episode in the slightest. So, likes and dislikes. I like this episode a lot, as I've said before. It's a great episode. And it has some really good performances in it by Cliff Robertson, by Edward Platt, by the guy that played Joe. I can't remember his name right now off the top of my head. And I hate to say that. But, well done all the way around. It was casted well. It was shot well. It was, technically, you know, minus a few little quirks here and there about the hands on the glass and which hand the rifle is in and that sort of thing, and the factual inaccuracies of New Mexico and the discovery of penicillin. It's a perfect episode, almost a perfect episode in style and form and function. Now, I say that, and it's not my favorite episode, not by a shot, but it is a great episode. And if you are looking for one that maybe you haven't seen in a while, pop this one in and give it a look. It's a pretty good episode, I think. And it starts off a run of some of the best, in my opinion, episodes of The Twilight Zone to come at the latter half of the second season, which is where we find ourselves now. And I'm excited for it. And with that, let's move into casting. So if Hollywood were to call me and say, Bill, we're going to remake this episode, who would you cast to play these people? And I will tell you who I would cast to play these people. Well, for Christian Horn, I would cast Eddie Redmayne. If you don't know who that is, look him up. He's a pretty good actor, and he has the right look for it, for sure. And for Joe and Mary Lou, Giovanni Ribisi, and for Mary Lou, Lindsay Lohan. Why? Because kind of like Evans in this episode, she's just annoying enough to make it work. And she's actually not a bad actress when you get down to it. So I would, you know, I think it would work out just fine. So there's that. And then for the doctor, I would cast, just for fun, Sean Astin, John Astin's kid. Cast him as the doctor. And I think we've got a winning combination there, folks. I think we do. Now, as far as the moral or philosophy of this episode, I mean, it's really open to interpretation, isn't it? You can't always get what you want, but sometimes you get what you need, you know? I mean, take your pick. You know, work requires action, and action breeds consequences, and sometimes the consequences are good and sometimes they're not. And in this situation, Chris Horn healed his son, and his son had a fantastic career, and they were able to make it to California and lived happily ever after. But maybe the idea is that sometimes you have to do what's hard in order to reap the rewards that you're looking for. And maybe that's it. And perseverance is a great thing. And maybe that's what we're meant to learn from this one. I don't know. Just a thought. And it's a good thought. At least I think so. But if you think casting should be different, or you have another, you know, idea of who you would cast in either previous or future episodes, drop me a email at dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear your thoughts on it. And with that, I think we can bring this episode more toward a landing. I do have one listener feedback email that I'll share with you. And it's from a newer listener, Doug, who writes to me and says, "Hello, Mr. Couch. I'm a fan of your podcast." So I appreciate that, Doug. I am curious to know what number I've become. I think we're somewhere around 19, Doug. So congratulations. Maybe 20. Let's call you 20 right now. You're number 20. Congratulations. He says, I'm in a Twilight Zone marathon, not of the television show, but of your podcast. I appreciate that. I'm only on the beginning of season 2 and I'm trying to catch up. Well, you don't have a whole lot more to do before you catch up because we're only right near the end of season 2. So there you go. Here's my only feedback. Did you ever consider doing the podcast with another person? You would have 2 points of view and can even debate in a nice way and maybe change the other's minds. I did have a special guest in, Catherine, who was on the episode, A Passage for Trumpet, which, I plan on having her back at some point, and I do plan on having some other guests as well, but I've never really thought of it as more of a one-person thing, to be honest with you. Not that I couldn't do a two-person thing, but that often, sadly, leads to a lot of issues with scheduling and whatnot. And would I love another person to do this with? Absolutely. And like I said, I'm definitely going to have some more guests and whatnot on. But yeah, that's just, you know, maybe I will in the future. I'm not sure at this point in time, to be honest with you. Let's see. He goes on to write, I don't think it's necessary to say in each episode where to find it on cable or DVD. Most know where to. Also, don't worry about spoilers. Most saw every episode, and if they didn't, they wouldn't be listening to the podcast. You're not necessarily wrong, Doug, but on the off chance that number 21 comes along, you know, I don't want to spoil anything for him. So there's that. He goes on to say, if Hollywood was asking you or me who can play certain actors instead of the originals, he's got a few ideas. He says, in one for the Angels, Billy Crystal to play the Ed Wynn part. And that's actually a fantastic. I didn't even think of Billy Crystal, to be honest with you. Mr. Denton on Doomsday, Tom Hanks as Mr. Denton. That's a great one. That's a great idea. Of course, Tom Hanks, the man could sit there and read a phone book for 2 hours and it would be a great performance. So, I mean, you know, that would be a good one. I would love to see him playing a fall down drunk. You know, I think that would be a great thing to see. For the lonely Paul Giamatti. My goodness, what that man can, again, great actor, great man. And I think he would definitely add, a level of sadness to that role that may not have necessarily been there in the original. So that's a great one, too. Time Enough at Last, Steve Martin. Again, Steve Martin, another guy that could literally do funny, serious, everything in between. Yeah, I could see that. A Nice Place to Visit, Pip, Jack Black, and Joe Pesci for Rocky Valentine. I like that idea. I think that would be a great match because both can be funny and both can be very serious and both are very good at doing either one. And I think Jack Black could definitely be menacing given the, given the right circumstances. And lastly, What You Need, Tony Danza. You know, a lot of people always make fun of, or always did make fun, he kind of quit working, but always did make fun of Tony Danza because they always said, well, every role he plays, he has to be named Tony because he can't remember anybody else's name and that kind of thing. And you're not necessarily, you know, Tony Danza is actually a decent actor, but he never really got he never really, I don't think, was given a chance to have a huge, just meaty sort of great role. Because if you remember, all we really know him for is Taxi and Who's the Boss. And in both, he played a guy named Tony. One was a cab driver, the other one was a nanny. Or housekeeper, or handyman, whatever he was supposed to be in Who's the Boss. It's been about you know, a month of Sundays since I've seen that show, but I do remember watching it as a kid. So I think it's more or less, and I think it's not a bad idea, because I don't think he was ever given much of the opportunity to actually do anything other than be on a sitcom. And I think that's, crap. I think he could have done some good things if given the proper ability. Doug goes on to write, I know you have a strong dislike for the Mighty Casey. I do. Again, some people like it, some people don't. That's what's the beauty about this episode or about this show or about any sort of art or media in general. You can love it, you can hate it. It doesn't matter. It's all subjective. And I never will disparage anyone for having their own opinion on anything. He goes on to say, it is my favorite comedy episode. He says, which is not saying much. Well, I mean, again, it's subjective. If you like it, you like it. If you don't, you don't. As for the poem, Casey at the Bat, it was based on Ernest Thayer's best friend, Samuel Winslow, who played college, who played baseball in college at Harvard. On the closing narration, Rod Serling was talking about the Dodgers, and the players were Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale. And I never knew that, and I appreciate you passing along that piece of information, Doug. I really do. I really do appreciate it. And he says, you really care about the Twilight Zone, and the detailed information is appreciated. Keep going. Sincerely, Doug. Thank you, Doug, for the feedback, and I really do appreciate it, and I appreciate you and the 19 other people that listen to this show. I really do appreciate you all, and thank you so much for listening. Doug, thank you so much for writing in. I always love to hear people's feedback, so again, if you have any, write to me, dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. And with that, stay tuned for next week's episode where four guys decide to go camping in a cave for 100 years. Stay tuned for the Rip Van Winkle caper coming up next week. Thank you, everybody. Have a good night, and we'll see you next time.